So we're now joined on Saturday Chronicle on this particular piece, which is about National Poetry Day, which is the next week. And we're joined by Mary O'Connor, and very pleased to have you on board, Mary.
Oh, thank you, Cara.
Good. And Mary and I and Roisin spend many a nice evening together in our writers group, which we have in the library and which I'm really missing at the moment. Are you missing it?
Oh, terribly. Yeah.
You get such encouragement from others. I mean, I don't write poetry. I try and write fiction and that. But so anyway, Mary, you're going to we've been talking about haikus before, and I am quite new to understanding what a haiku is. So maybe you'd explain for the listeners what a haiku is.
Okay, Carol. I like to create images or stories in as few words as possible, which I suppose that's why I write poetry mainly. I particularly like the Japanese haiku form. What it is three lines of altogether 17 syllables. There's five syllables, seven syllables, and then the third line is five syllables. Traditionally, haiku also includes a seasonal reference, such as apple blossom for spring or gold leaves for autumn. Right. So I've written a few. Since the COVID lockdown, I've sort of written down a few. And I start with this one. I wrote this first one on Easter Saturday night after, remember the Shine a Light ceremony that we had?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. Wax tears down countless candles to melt the burrs of a wintry bandit. The next one I have, Things I Remember. That last hug with my friend, our laughter, the snowdrops. And after the lockdown started, I had no greens, so I had to improvise when I was cooking. So I wrote this one. To counter curfew, add young nettles to your stew, wild garlic leaves. That's it, Charles.
Oh, I love that. There is such imagery in that. And I mean, I'm thinking of the wax tears of that night. And I think there was more than wax tears, wasn't there, in that? Oh. There was something very, very poignant about that moment on Easter Saturday night. Maybe because, as well, it's traditionally associated with that vigil with Saturday. And I remember as a child always being really excited on Easter Saturday, just because Lent was over and you were going to get chocolate the next day. It wasn't really from a religious or spiritual point of view, but that's the absolute, putting into a haiku the memory of a hug, which actually now seems like such a long time ago, doesn't it?
They were absolutely beautiful, Mary. I loved the mention as well of the snowdrops. Yesterday, since the beginning of March, nearly, I had a little outing myself. I went all the way down to Aldi in Killaloe to do some shopping, and it was the first time I'd driven that far, or been out, and I couldn't get over the change in people's gardens.
Really?
Now that the last time I was out, we were looking at snowdrops. It's. Like, can you imagine people who are cocooned, who maybe don't even have a very big garden, and they haven't really been able to be out? And the next time they're out, it'll be like a whole different vegetation. It'll be literally, physically, a whole different world.
It's so unbelievable.
It's mad to think about it. Really, it really is. Mm. But it is what it is. They're fantastic, Mary.
She writes fabulous stuff. And Mary, how do you find your sort of, not so much inspiration, but, with all this time now and we don't have any distractions, as a writer, like, is this a good time for writing for you?
It's I found the haikus good when I felt something, you know, a strong feeling.
Yes.
But to go into longer stuff, I find I can't really concentrate. And it's funny, I was listening to Irina last night, and this novelist was said the exact same thing. She said she just couldn't get into the writing. She couldn't concentrate.
Yeah.
That sort of cheered me up because I was feeling a bit guilty, you know.
Yes, and Roisin and I were talking about this as well, about how we're probably better when there's deadlines or, you know, like everything else, like studying something, you have to nearly be told that essay has to be in by next Monday or whatever, you know, that if it's like a piece of string, you know, it's like, I'm not going to get that done. So anyway, I'm going, thank you so much, Mary. Hold on there now, because I'm sure you probably know this poem, and it's from Michael Hartnett, and Roisin was talking about the theme for Poetry Ireland this year, for Poetry Day, was time. And this poem is about a woman who seems that she was born outside of her time, but she couldn't really cope with the time that she was living in. And it's the poem that Michael Hartnett wrote when his grandmother died. He was living in Morocco at the time, and when he heard of his grandmother's death, and this is it. It's called Death of an Irish Woman. Ignorant in the sense she ate monotonous food and thought the world was flat, and pagan in the sense she knew the things that moved at night were neither dogs nor cats, but pukas and dark-faced men. She nevertheless had fierce pride, but sentenced in the end to eat thin, diminishing porridge. In a stone-cold kitchen, she clenched her brittle hands around a world she could not understand. I loved her from the day she died. She was a summer dance at the crossroads. She was a card game where a nose was broken. She was a song that nobody sings. She was a house ransacked by soldiers. She was a language seldom spoken. She was a child's purse full of useless things.
Wow,
it's a great one, really, about you know, this woman was born in the 1850s and, you know, lived through the troubles and you know, but couldn't quite move into the new world of the 1920s and 30s. You know, I mean, when we think of the changes that have happened in people's lives, but it's great. It's a great one, you know. So
that notion as well, I suppose, that we try and sum people up. You know, the way sometimes we try and sum people's lives, sum them up in tiny little, you know, like we look and we think we have the sum of the person, but we don't. You know what I mean? Isn't that part of that poem? It's like all of the different things that woman was, you know.
And the ability to be able to put into metaphors the description of her, which are so unique, you know. But I think so poignant, a summer dance at the crossroads, the idea. And I think it's also about rural life, which has changed so much. So it's a timeless piece. I think it was written in the 60s. You know, or maybe early 70s or whatever. So, now I think you've a piece, Ger, haven't you?
Well, since everybody was coming on board, I mean, as I say, I found this little piece pop up at me, and I thought it might bring a little bit of comfort. It's a beautiful little, very short poem by Derek Mahan, who's a Belfast poet, a man in his 70s now, and it's just entitled Everything Is Going to Be All Right. How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, there will be dying, but there's no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything.
Oh, that is beautiful. And I know I may have read it a long time ago, but I've forgotten it.
I know, it's a very, it's a very well-known little one, but it's so short, and it's easy to keep bits of it in your head, that notion of, you know, that the sun does rise in spite of everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, that very hard line in the middle, you know, that there will be dying, and that is...
But there is no need to go into it, you know, that's just great,
It's just going back to what we were talking about with Róisín, about how poetry kind of feeds the soul, so to speak. It's sometimes when you can't really explain, like Mary mentioned it there. You mentioned it there, Mary, about, you know, you write the haiku when you feel something, it's poetry is all about feeling, isn't it? It's about
I just noticed with Michael Harnett's one, just that the few words about that ransacked house. That painted a whole picture of our history, didn't it?
Yes,
and it was in relation to the black and tans. That was the line, you know. And, you know, it's just, I suppose, people were so, that was such a time of change. Like, we think we're in this terrible time of change as well. But, you know, this woman would have gone through the cultural revival, the start, you know, the republicanism of the time, the change in governments, the depression of the 30s, you know, all of the stuff that was there. And, you know, and I think sometimes if we think these are dark times, we have to think, like Derek Mahon said, that the sun will rise and that we will. It's an emotional roller coaster. You only have to just, half the time you go around the place, you might be crying, listen to a song, or then having a laugh if somebody sends something funny to you, like a joke or something. It's a funny time. It really is a strange time.
It is,
From over the water. This is just amazing. And we can actually see him on WhatsApp. He is walking around his flat. Now he's tidied it up. Thanks be to God, because I can see it. This is Eugene Scanlon, and we are so delighted to have you here, Eugene, with us on Scarlet Bay Community Radio. Now, Eugene, you are presently living in London. We'll get to that now. But tell us, your origins are, of course, what are your early origins in Church Street? Am I right? Yes.
Well, actually, the lane. The lane, as it was
the
known.
The lane.
Then.
Okay, right. Let's get it right.
Yes, the lane. And, born there in 1959. Went to school across the field up in the primary school.
Yes.
And then went to the Tech, of course, the famous Tech. Which was fantastic, great place, absolutely great place. And and then left Scariff in, God, it's hard to remember now, 1977? 76.
76, yeah.
Yeah. So
and headed for Scariff by the Sea, was it, in Galway?
Scariff by the Sea, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I went to UCG in 76, and spent 4 years there, 4 years in UCG, and then spent another probably about 12 years in Galway after that. I fell in love with it, absolutely, but who doesn't fall in love with Galway?
Yes, you know? You know that famous expression, you know, my son, loss of ambition, my son went to Galway.
Yeah. Well, I
lose your ambition.
No, and I always think the affinity is so close. My sister will go mad when she hears me saying this. When I said to her one day that I thought that Clare should be in Connacht, and she said, and this was on the phone, and there was complete silence. I had to say, hello, are you still there? And she said, is that what you think? And I said, well, come on, you know, we have far more in common with Galway people than we do with Tipperary. And she still wasn't having any of it. And Mike Sullivan told me not to say it in too many places or I might get my face pushed in, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine that. So but, you, know, you studied... You know, did you study arts, Eugene? Was it arts you studied?
Yeah, I did. In those days, it was four subjects in first year. So I did English, geography, French and archaeology. Then you dropped one each year. And
yes.
I ended up doing a degree in English and geography. Yeah. So, yes. And then I went on to do the H-Dip, but there were a lot of personal things going on in my life that year, so I never actually finished it. So
okay.
I subsequently finished it over here, 20, 30 years later.
Really?
Did the English version of it, the PGCE, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you've been how many years now in London, Eugene?
I've been here 35 years this year, and it would have been it would have been the last place in the world I would have chosen to live,
because
it was never a conscious decision. And in fact, when I think back of what I was like then, I mean, England would have been very daunting for me. I would have been classic kind of carrying all that baggage about being Irish, being really self-conscious of being in kind of, I don't know, what was then a kind of a hostile environment, if you want. It certainly wasn't popular to be Irish in London in those days. But I was 20, I was coming up to being 25 in September, and it was the last opportunity I had to do the interrailing. And so I told friends, look, I'm going to go on the interrail for a month. I may or may not come back. And I traveled around Europe, then the ticket ran out and I hitched down to the south of France and stayed with two friends there until November of that year. Then I decided I'd come to London. I've got friends here. I can get a job, save some money and go back to Europe. And 35 years later, I'm still here.
Have you got the ticket stub of the Interrail for the next part of it? But you have travelled a lot since then as well, haven't you? You've been you did the Camino, and you were a big exposure to that. Listen, so you're in London, and we have a fascination with knowing how everybody else is getting on in the world and comparing ourselves. And one of the things I was thinking about this show was, how could we get somebody to, not just what you see on Sky News or whatever, what's it like in London during lockdown now? How do you feel things are there now?
Yeah, well, I suppose it, do you know, in some ways, I think probably it's the same everywhere. I mean, it's not the same for everybody, that's for sure. And, you know, there's been a big backlash here to celebrities and politicians and news presenters saying, you know, we're all in this together. We're not all in it together. You know, there are lots of people who are living 30 floors up in overcrowded conditions, you know, families of 6 and 7 in 2-bedroom flats. There's no gardens, there's no parks, I might be sidetracking here, but, you know, I mean, I'm very, very lucky in that, you know, I'm working from home. I'm still getting my salary into my account. I have a beautiful park up the road, so I do 10 or 12 kilometres of a power walk around that park every day. But the lockdown is not the same for everybody, that's for sure. And of course, there's a huge amount of, you know, there's massive unemployment. Not everybody, you know, it's one size doesn't fit all. They introduce legislation, but there are lots of people that fall through that legislation and they don't qualify for this grant or they don't qualify for that benefit. And, you know, I got money back the other day from tickets that I booked for the theatre. And I immediately just transferred it into the local food bank because they are absolutely at their wit's end. They are inundated. They're absolutely inundated and they're begging for donations and that. So there is that side to it. But, you know, when you have your routine, it's probably like anywhere. You know, I get up in the morning, I have a shower, same as I would. I'm at the kitchen table, which is my office, at 8:30. At 4:30, I go out to Queen's Park. I do my kind of hour and a half, 2 hours. I break the rules. I'm out for longer than an hour. But, you know, and I sometimes meet. Yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, I think you'll be okay with disclosing that because we don't think anyone in Scotland Yard is listening in to Scariff Bay Community Radio. Although we can't be sure.
Oh,
you're okay with that, Eugene. Eugene, I'm just wondering about you now work in after years of being teaching English and drama, being head of department in the school that you work in. You explained to me you're in a different job in you're a mentor and a support for sixth year. Now, can I just ask you about the school that you work in? what kind of a community does it serve in terms of their socioeconomic background? And
yeah, it's a Church of England school, and actually, I have to tell you, this is a little aside because it's quite funny. Years ago, my mother, bless her, when she was alive, I got the job, and she said, "Oh, that's fantastic. You can walk to school." And I said, "Yes, I can actually walk to the school. It's brilliant." She said, "Oh, I'm thrilled you got it now. And what kind of a school is it?" And I said, "You know," I said, there's a huge variety of schools here, you know. And she said, "Yeah, but what kind of a school is it?" And I said, "Well, it's a church school." And she said, "Oh, that's great. And that's lovely. And what kind of a church is it?" And I said, "Well, it's Church of England." And she said, "Oh, well, that's great, you know, blah, blah, blah." And then we went down and talked about Israel and South Africa and, you know, whatever. she was a great, you know, she was a great talker. Clued in on what was going on in the world. And then out of the blue, she just dropped in as if I wouldn't notice it. She said, "And were there no Catholic schools looking for drama teachers?"
Good on you, Bridie. Yeah. Yes, that would be. Of the time. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm always very proud of you too.
Yeah. So I moved. I finished teaching last August. I thought, you know, I really had had enough of it. I'd had enough of the, you know, the weekends and the bank holidays and, the, you know, doing the school shows and rehearsing practical drama with the students. You know, it's a long, slow process. And, you know, the nights and weekends and bank holidays, I just thought I've had enough. And it's a very stressful job. And I hit 60 in September and I thought, you know what, I've done my stint. And, you know, I've been in the school 20 years and they've been really, really good to me. So I've got a job now working with the sixth form, which is post 16. So the students would be 17 in their first year, then 18 in their second year, and then they do their A-level exams. And so I mentor the students. So I'm able to do a lot of that online here from home. I'm responsible for their work experience program. I'm responsible for their UCAS applications, you know, their university applications. And the big thing here is personal statements and references, and they're very time consuming. So I kind of work with them on that. And then I also have responsibility for, I do a little bit of teaching, and it's called EPQ. It's an extended project qualification. And it's the students pick their own topic. So it could be beekeeping in suburban gardens, whatever they want to do. And I just have to teach them research skills and how to write up a report, how to do an analysis, a rationale, and a report. So I mark those as well. So in fact,
that's an interesting work now.
Yeah,
very interesting. Yeah. Geraldine, you might want to come in there. Geraldine was a teacher.
I have a piece of paper here in front of me. I have 20 million things written on it now. I don't know where to start. I'm fascinated by the fact that you teach drama, because I'm a real drama buff, and that you're now mentoring. But your work sounds absolutely fascinating. But you mentioned that it was difficult and stressful. I'm a retired teacher myself, Eugene. I taught down here in what used to be the Tech, which became Scariff Community College.
Everybody stood
in it after that.
I won't hold the change of name against it, but it'll always be the Tech to me.
Now. Yeah. Well, that's a whole other story. I mean, the Department of Education still thinks that it's the Tech. When I was there, they still sent posts that says the technical school, vocational, no, not tech, vocational school.
That's right.
Much to John S's absolute, he used to go off his head when he found. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah.
But the stresses of, I would have had colleagues in the past, and I know now my daughter's a teacher as well, and she has friends who teach in London, and there is... massive stress, and not just London, but just the UK system seems to overload teachers. Or is that fair to say?
Oh God, massively. I mean, it's like a completely different ball game over here to what it is in Ireland, from what I can ascertain.
Yes.
I actually have a friend who runs the Women in Politics department in UCG, Anne Byrne. And one of her students was actually doing research on this subject, because there were so many young teachers that were being recruited by agencies over here, young Irish teachers, who were coming over and falling by the wayside within the first year. Mm. And the numbers were so high that Anne actually sanctioned one of her students doing some research on it to find out, you know, now it hasn't been published yet, you know, what's going on. Now, I think what's going on is I did my training here.
Yeah.
And so I was very aware of what was ahead of me.
Okay.
I think what happens is when teachers are trained in Ireland, then they come over here to a completely different system. And I think they're absolutely shocked. It's, you know, constant monitoring. Your lessons are monitored every half term, even some place fortnightly, some places weekly. You have somebody in the room watching your teaching. And if you're consistently told that your lessons are unsatisfactory, and in some cases, some people that I've actually spoken to, some Irish people who were consistently told that, but were never given a reason for it. They were, and they were never helped. They were never assisted in how to rectify their unsatisfactory lessons. It is, and the workload, it's absolutely, I mean, the workload is huge. I mean, I don't know any teacher that leaves school before 6 o'clock in the evening. And most of those people would be in there at 8 in the morning.
And I mean, you said you taught for 20 years. You must have absolutely loved it, Eugene.
I did. I absolutely
because I don't know how you would stick it otherwise.
I loved it. And you know, I often say that the payback is because I live and work in the same area, I meet the students all the time on the streets, current students and ex-students. And I absolutely love meeting ex-students because they're always so excited to see you. They'll stop on the street. They cannot wait to tell you what they're doing. And it's the most heartwarming feeling because you walk away at the end of it and you think, that's why you do it. That's why you do it. That you might have played some small part in in this young man or this young woman's lives, you know. And most of them have turned out like beautiful, beautiful young people. Really lovely.
True, absolutely. I can agree with that. Yeah.
Sorry, could I just ask you, getting back to the community that you serve in your school, you know, do you have the fear, like I'm hearing from other teachers here, about children slipping through? I know these are secondary school, older children, but they're still children, slipping through because they're not at school. Is your school one of the schools that's still open?
Yeah, we're still open. We are open for the children of key workers and vulnerable children. Now we only have about 5 is the most I think we've had in. The community we service, well, the irony is that it's a Church of England school, but probably approximately 80 to 84% of our students would be from Muslim backgrounds, Muslim and Afro-Caribbean. And it's very working class. The school is located in the middle of kind of tower block territory. So kind of very working class area. We have an outstanding grading from Ofsted. We do very well. We're in the top 12 percentile in the country for progress made by our students. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Wow, that's something.
Incredibly dedicated staff, you know, people.
Oh, it must be.
And what size school, Eugene, is it?
Have just about 1,000, so which would be kind of relatively small by London standards, you know, but probably big enough by Irish standards. But yes, there is that issue. For instance, I'm constantly doing my mentoring and, you know, we've had several emails through from students saying, I'm not feeling very well. I don't feel my mental health is very good. Now, we have a project running where we've got a well-being project where students can access that over the phone or through chat or, you know, we don't do videos so far. It's a bit of an issue around safeguarding and videos from schools, you know. But yes, we have vulnerable students, but the thing is, they're not the ones that are coming in. The ones that are coming into the school tend to be the key workers' children. The vulnerable children, yes, that is an issue.
They're not showing up here.
Yeah, but we are, you see, they would all have been identified anyway. So you have members of senior management on the phone to them all the time, ensuring that, you know, safeguarding issues are dealt with, any, you know, if there are any. But also just trying to offer support and guidance, you know, because it's a strange time. It's we closed quite abruptly, and our 6 month students are year 13, like the second year. They would have been doing their exams this year. I mean, they were absolutely kind of in a state of shock. I mean, a lot of the, you could divide it down sex lines. It was very stereotypical, actually. Some of the boys were punching the air. Yes, that means I don't have to study anymore. A lot of the girls were crying and really upset because this was the end of their school life and there was no ceremony, no formal ending. And I think that's really hard, you know.
And they don't sit at their exams now.
Were cancelled here. So that batch of EPQs that I got in yesterday evening, deadline was 5 o'clock. I'm going to mark those and I will be basing their A-level grade will be based on the mark I give them. But I think
that's a huge controversial element here in terms of, you know, the Leaving Cert.
Yeah,
they're going to go ahead with it in some shape or form.
Yeah,
there's no question of giving an estimated grade here.
Well, you see, one of the things they've done here, which I think is good, is, you know, you'll have a national moderation, of course, of all the results when they're sent in. But what they also intend doing nationally is they will look at our data for the school. They look at all the data going back over the last 5 or 10 years. So they will have a rough idea of what our results are anyway. So if there's a huge lurch forward, they'll think, no, we're not having this, you know.
Yeah,
so,
and that's not in place here, you see, in the Irish system, which would make you know, just personally, I know it's awfully hard for people who are in Leaving Cert and for parents who have children in Leaving Cert and families and so on. But I don't see any other way. I think it would be, there is no other system in place just at the minute. Maybe there should be, but there isn't. Yeah. So we kind of have to run with what we have in some way.
I'm getting a bit conscious of time. And what I'm thinking of is that, Eugene, if you are happy to be our regular London correspondent for Saturday Chronicle, we can certainly offer you a regular slot here, because I'm looking at Jim Collins' face and I'm looking at Geraldine's face here on the WhatsApp here, and we're all just like, one more, and we have to stop because there is a deadline to this. But we're going to wind up. Thank you so much for coming on, but we're going to wind
up.
You're
welcome.
Give us your story on the piece of music you have chosen.
It's just a personal story, really. The week building up to, well, first to put it in context, I absolutely love Easter. It is the most beautiful time of the year for me. I love it even more than Christmas. I love the spring, it's blossom, it's daffodils, it's hope, it's renewal, it's all those wonderful things. I absolutely love it. Ever since I was a kid, I've loved it. And so it was coming up to Easter weekend, and of course we were in our lockdown, and it all felt very strange. And I think you kind of go through a pattern. The first week is a kind of, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know your elbow from your backside because you're trying to get used to this. And then the second week, you kind of start getting into a pattern. And then I think the third week, you start thinking about, what is all this? What does all this mean? Where does it fit in all our lives? And there was a melody going round and round in my head coming up to Easter weekend. And I couldn't place what it was. And I didn't know the name of the song. So I couldn't do a search anywhere for it. So, but it just kept going round and round in my head. I don't know whether I'd been dreaming about it or, you know, the way it happens. You just don't know where it comes from. So I sat down at the piano here, and I have an electric piano here, and I played it and recorded it. And I sent it to Michael Sullivan. And
Michael Sullivan. As you would.
Can you identify it? And Mike got back straight away, of course. Jer was out sunning herself, so she didn't, you know, she just couldn't be bothered, you know. And, Not true, Jerry. And Mike sent back and he said, well, he said the title, the song is in the title. It's actually the West Coast of Clare. So I knew there was references to Spanish Point and all of that. So I found it on Spotify and I played it. And, oh, God, I've no shame in saying the tears came. And I sat here and I wept listening to it because it's such a beautiful song. And the melody is so evocative and the words are beautiful. And Andy Irvine's gorgeous voice. And it's a love song. And it's about going back to West Clare, to where they originally met. And it just brought up. Oh, I felt nostalgic and I felt sentimental. And I felt this time of year, I would normally be in Ireland. It's where I love to be at Easter and Clare and all of that. So I had no hesitation when you said you the song. That's it.
We're going to play it, but first of all, give a shout out to your family in Scariff, Kilkishan, Mount Shannon. Give a shout out.
Hello,
Chicago.
Everybody. I'm not going to mention anybody by name because I'll probably leave somebody out and I'll never hear the end of it. They'll be saying, Jesus, that fellow over there, you didn't even mention us. So hello, Scannons all over. Hello, Mike. Hello, Jer. Hello, everybody. I hope you're all surviving the lockdown. And if I could post it to you, I would, but I spend a lot of time making sourdough bread. Somebody gave me 16 kilos of bread flour. So I've been baking bread like a maniac for the whole street.
we're gonna be back on to you about that. Eugene Scanlon, thank you so much.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Look forward to seeing you. Bye. Thanks, Eugene.
Bye.
So we have kept the best wine to last, as they say. That cliche is very true. She's become known as the Scariff Bay Community Radio's chief of staff, I'm telling you. That's what she's been called on Facebook and all over the place. You're very, very welcome this morning. Marie McNamara, you're welcome to our Chronicle. How are you?
Thank you very much, ladies. I think it was Owen and Ruth O'Hagan got that. There's only one chief of staff around here, and it's certainly not me, and it's not even a female. I can tell you that. Great show, ladies. It was lovely listening to Eugene there. Eugene was a couple of years ahead of me at school.
He's wonderful. Yeah, he was a great man. He's a great man to tell a story and a great man. We could have gone on and on for ages with Eugene, for sure. So we've asked you to come on this morning, Marie, to talk about your real job, the one that you actually get paid a little bit for, possibly not enough, I would say, but I don't know. I'm not privy to that, but you know. But tell us a little bit about your job that you do on a daily basis. Tell us a little bit about that before we get into the challenges and so on.
Okay, thank you. Well, I suppose thanks for the recognition first and the opportunity, ladies. I work for a Clare-based agency who provides home health for elderly and vulnerable people in the community. And I suppose, you know, a lot of people are off this weather, but we're busier than ever, really. And the calls are taking longer because, I suppose, really, to put it in context, people are very, very worried, the people that most of us visit. Like, there's loads of us in the community, you know, and we all have our own various clients and people that we call to on a daily basis, 7 days a week. You know, it's usually every second weekend or whatever. But they were very, very worried up to a couple of weeks ago. And I think this cocooning has absolutely freaked a lot of them out altogether. Mm-hmm. It really has. Some of them are afraid to put their foot outside the door. They think the guards are going to come along and take them in. You know, it really has frightened a lot of them. Mm-hmm. It really has.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's some of them, their grandchildren can't visit. They're not all on FaceTime. Mm-hmm. WhatsApp on the phone seems to be the best that if the mother can visit maybe, or the daughter can visit the grandparents and to show the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. It's about the only way they have of dealing with it. Mm-hmm. If you're living out the country, it might be too bad. They can go outside and walk around the garden. But if you're living in the town, there's really nowhere to go.
Yes,
and some of them are living on their own. Some have family living with them that are home in the evenings. But if you're living on your own and you've no garden, it's not healthy for mind or body to be on your own in the house all day thinking about things.
No.
Marie, can I ask you in relation to your own? And I am so glad that, you know, in the talk of frontline workers and everything, I have felt very strongly for a number of weeks that those working in the community are not being acknowledged enough. You know, so I'm really glad that this is a particular piece which is about carers in the home. Just such a vital job. Mm. And I'm just wondering about your own safety and your own. Do you need to wear PPE? Do you have to wear masks? Do you have to wear anything when you go into the house?
It depends. Well, yes, technically we have. Yes, gloves. Sterilizer, our hands are withered from that. There's a lot of hand cream going on at night. And it only came into law this week about the masks. Up to then, it was personal. It was depending whether the family wanted it, whether you wanted it yourself. But as in from Thursday, we have to wear masks going in, which and for somebody that's going in that suffers from dementia is... Sorry, Geraldine?
Sorry, Marie. I was going to say, and is that presenting a difficulty? Because I presume they're scarce, are they?
Absolutely. We were given six masks.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. You're supposed to wear a different mask every time you go into somebody. It isn't physically possible. And if you're going into someone that suffers from dementia and you walk into the house with a mask, it can really freak them out. You know, it's heartbreaking, really. It is.
Are your calls, you mentioned your calls need to be longer. I mean, this idea of being able to sort somebody out in 20 minutes or something, I mean, that must be ridiculous. Like, you must have to spend longer.
Totally, Carl, because by the time you've gone in and, you know, had a little chat, if you're going in, you know, gowned up and everything with your gloves and with the mask, you have to sort of put them at ease as well, even though they all do know us because we're going in daily. But it's very different to what it was even a month ago, even a week ago. It's very, really? Very different. They're cleaning all the time because they're so nervous and they think they're going to be called in to be tested regardless. You know, it's when are we going to be called? One particular person, they all got a leaflet during the week. It was, I think it was community call. It was about COVID-19 and explaining to them, I think, most people. And they all thought it was a big meeting in the community hall that they were all going to be called up. It's, you know, what's very small to us is a very big problem to them.
Yes.
People don't seem to realize that. But you know what? It's bringing out the best in people. There are people, you know, ringing their neighbors that maybe they didn't know that well, but they know they're living on their own, and just ringing and say, look, I'm passing. Will I drop a newspaper? Do you want a few messages? And, you know, I've spoken about it before. Evan Mack and Nuala are both taking orders for dinners, dropping dinners regularly to people. You know, you can ring order and pay over the phone. And that is just fantastic. You know, and of course, the Raheem Day Centre being closed is an awful setback.
I was speaking to, you know, in relation to Raheem, making another programme with Raheem the other day. I didn't know. They told me that there were up to 200 people who normally go in there on their books.
I mean,
obviously, it's not just Scariff, it's the whole of East Clare. Like, I mean, it's really a massive area. And people must be so missing that connection.
And some people would have gone in there every day. The bus collects you sort of one day a week or one day a fortnight, depending on the areas. But a lot of people I would be familiar with would have gone in every day. The family might drop them in the morning and collect them in the evening or whatever. So, like, their routine is just totally gone. They were getting a lovely hot dinner, getting lovely tea and scones and the company, and they could have got their hair done when they were there and things like that. But you know, on a positive note, Steph from the day centre has rang most of those. I know one particular client I called her, and she's got two phone calls from Steph in the day centre just to check to see how they're doing and everything. That's just fantastic.
That's very good.
Yeah, good. It really is. Yeah. You know, but I suppose it's not all negative, but it is quite difficult. So I would just say to people, if you know of anybody living near you that's elderly, you know, you needn't even ring them and say, are you cocooning? Because then you're kind of trying to find out their age. But just say, you know, do you want anything? Or even just ring for a chat and talk about the weather or something. Because it means a lot. It means a lot.
And so, speaking of music, Marie, and with everybody else this morning, and indeed with your good self, you've chosen something for us. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, I like Nothing Compares to You from Sinead O'Connor. I suppose Sinead has had a troubled life, but I just think it's a classic song. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to dedicate it to our daughter, Aideen. She's 27 on Monday. And I think it's the quietest birthday she's ever had in her life.
Happy birthday, Aideen. Okay.
Happy birthday in advance, Aideen. Well done. Thanks a million, Marie.
Thank you.
Okay. So just want to wrap up now and say to all our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this morning's Saturday Chronicle. There were some small technical problems, but in fairness, considering all that's going on, a great thanks to Jim Collins, our sound engineer, for getting this all together. We put a number of resources on the Facebook page, which are things that might distract you or amuse you during the week, some online resources, some television programmes, some classic GAA matches. So you can check that out on our Facebook page. It's been a pleasure to be with you, Geraldine, this morning. So have a nice week.
It was my pleasure to be with you, Carl. We had a great old fun with the whole thing. Absolutely. Yeah, it was good.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. And thanks to our guests, to everybody who joined us this morning, in particular to you, Jean, to our poets, Roisin and Mary, to Marie, who just has given us that lovely song choice there at the end, Special thank you to Jim. Thanks to our sponsors of Saturday Chronicle. James Nash and Co. and Dirk Kitchens, I do believe. James is very impressed that I remembered all of that out of my own head. And, do take care, everybody, until next time, and thanks for listening.